No, that your English seems perfectly adequate for the task to me.
Maybe it is understandable, but I think it is not always very good.
That's all right. People, you know, the French are very particular about how people speak French, but we in the United States are less judgmental about that because we barely have mastered our own language.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
we
see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast. Anselm Jappe is the author of several major works of critical theory, most famously a book entitled simply Guy Debord, which is a critical biography of the famous leader of the Situationist International. And he is a contributor to the German Kritik of Value journal, Crisis. His books have received international interest and have been translated into a number of languages, including English. His most recent book is entitled The Writing on the Wall. It's in English, translated, and it's being published by Zero Books. It's Wednesday, October 25th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're a current member of the Zero Books Club, I want to remind you that we're moving the Inside Zero Books podcast from the Zero Books blog to Patreon. This will make it easier to get the members-only podcast on a podcatcher, and we're navigating over to the Patreon completely at the end of this month. So in November, we're going to discontinue the Zero Books blog version of the Inside Zero Books podcast. I also want to urge you to pick up Anselm Jappe's The Writing on the Wall. It's an excellent book. And you might also get a hold of Philip Cunliffe's Lenin Lives. And of course, if you haven't read it already, get yourself a copy of Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. The music you're listening to right now is a MIDI version of The Robots by Kraftwerk, but in just a moment you'll be listening to Anselm Jappe and I discuss Crisis, Value, and the Writing on the Wall. How did you come to write the essays that we've published in your book, The Writing on the Wall?
So before I write another bigger book, which is called The Adventures of Commodity, that was published in France in 2003. Unfortunately, still there is no English translation, but maybe it will come out next year. In that book, I was giving a kind of resume of what is the critic of a value. That means I especially tried to resume what had been developed since the 80s. On the one hand, by the German Marxist Review Crisis and its main author Robert Kurz, and I also referred a lot to American and Canadian author Moishe Postone and his big book titled Labor and Social Domination. So I tried to give a more systematic overview about what the critic of value has, on the one hand, had to say about Karl Marx as an interpretation of Marx's central categories, value, commodity, abstract labor, and money. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I also tried to show how these concepts can be useful to understand our history on one side, but also contemporary issues and sociological issues. But it was quite a theoretical book, also with a lot of quotations. In the following years, I write a series of essays and review articles or sometimes newspaper articles, often about arguments they asked me, which were more linked to the to topic themes. And so the book is, which was called in the French original Crédit Amour, is a collection of 12 essays which is a kind of putting the critic of value to work to use it about more concrete subjects.
That is what it was most interesting to me, was that you were taking Marxist categories which often are ignored even by Marxists, and trying to apply them to concrete political problems that were contemporary in the moment.
Yes, not completely ignored, but also there is a big difference between what we call an exoteric and esoteric Marx. There is a much better noun of Marx theory about, especially the part about class struggle and historical materialism, and another less well known, and as we call it, esoteric, heard of Marx theory, which is especially his critic of value of money and commodity and labor. And so I especially use these categories as analytical tools to understand contemporary world, also showing by this way. And these categories of Marx are not at all overcome now. Maybe some other part of his work can seem to have overcome in 150 years of evolution, but not this kind of categorical core of his theory.
Yes, I agree. I interviewed Moshe Pastone yesterday.
Oh.
And I've interviewed him once before, and I've read some of his major work.
Time, Labor, and Social Domination, the big book he wrote. He wrote one big book, I guess.
Right, and it won an award in theory, and it's been relatively influential book. How important is Postone's interpretation for your own theory?
It is very, very important one, as I told you. I first wrote a book about the situationist in Guy Debord, which has been published in 1993 in the Italian original, and it came out in 1999 in the United States with University of California Press. But after having written this book about Debord, I got across nearly by accident at the Critic of Value in its German form, and I was very, very struck to see that there was an analysis such as radical, such as clear as did the Situationist in their time. It was different from Situationist analysis, but there was the same degree of consequently radical thinking. So a little bit afterwards, I also got aware of Postone's work, so which has a little bit more an academic character. It is more systematical, and there is one big book, and it is more limited to the interpretation of Marx. So this was very important for me, especially to test my own understanding of Marx. On the other hand, there are also some important differences between Postone's view and the view of the German critic of value.
What would you say the most important distinction is between those two?
I think the one distinction is the crisis theory. For crisis, it is important to say that the logic of abstract labor, and also the replacement of living labor as technologies, leads absolutely to a final crisis of capitalism, which is already going on since several years, and which means that capitalism encounters its own inner limits, which in reality have been there from the beginning. This aspect is not very much developed or even explicitly denied by Postone, who thinks that there is all that the relationship between time and value is always reestablished on a higher level. So for Postone, there is no inward tendency of capitalism towards crisis, and the overcoming of capitalism for Postone will depend mainly on the contradiction between the possibilities of productive forces and reality, especially in terms of abolishing unnecessary labor. The second big difference, I would say, is that Postone often seems to really want to interpret what Marx really said. He polemizes very much against traditional Marxism, but it seems that he pretends to really get what Marx wanted to say. To me, it is more important to see that there is a kind of inner contradiction also in Marx's own work, that in part Marx was also a traditional Marxist, but even the esoteric part of his work is still important enough to say that nobody contributes so much to an understanding of today's world as Marx does. And the third, I would say, difference is that Postone shows very well that labor has a very special place in capitalist society, and labor is no longer the object of some social conventions, but becomes a social nexus between people, and that labor is no more the object of decisions, but become itself a fetishistic medium. But what lacks, what I would say, the German critic of value would say, what lacks in Postone is the critic of the concept of labor itself, and to see that in pre-capitalistic societies we cannot even speak of an existence of labor as distinct from other kinds of human activity. So I met Postone several times, but finally we did not really succeed, I think, to have a profound discussion about that.
What was the difficulty? Was there just too clear or too deep a disagreement between you about these?
On the one hand, he said that there is not such a strong disagreement. He said that he did not pretend to want to restore the real Marx against all the distortions. But he also admitted that there might be a contradiction in Marx itself. But in his works, it does not really appear. As to the crisis theory, I think there is a real difference. But we have met several times at congresses about Marx in several places of the world. But finally, maybe that was not the good place to have a more profound theoretical discussion.
Well, perhaps sometime in the future, I could arrange for you and Moshe Postone to speak again for a podcast.
I had several times the opportunity, but it's also too, I think, that as the chief thinker of the German part of Critique of Value, the late Robert Kurz was a very polemical person who also liked often to attack others. Postone, on the other hand, I think Postone has also a very kind nature, and normally he tries, I think, to stay away from polemical stands.
Right, and I appreciate that. That's what I aim at as well these days. I think there's too many attacks from one part of the left on the other where a more fruitful debate might be had. I tend to think my own view on crisis theory, which is very much influenced by a short-lived friendship and relationship I had with an economist named Andrew Kleiman.
What was his name?
Andrew Kleiman.
Yes, I heard that name, I think, yes.
Yes, and he's an influential Marxist in these around value theory. In any case, my view of crisis is that crisis is built into the capitalist economy, and that a crisis is its own solution on capitalists in terms of, if you're looking at it from the point of view of capital, in other words,
yes,
the destruction of capital will then be able to lead the way to a new boom. The human damage done can be tremendous and has been, but in terms of just the logic of capitalism, crisis is its own solution.
Yes, this is a very widespread theory. On the one hand, in for Marxists and also for many non-Marxists. So that means more or less that that capitalism could continue forever if it does not meet an exterior exterior limit. So this theory, normally only which you assume, normally admits only the existence of cyclical crises, and especially what is called underconsumption crises. That's to say that there is not enough consumption of by the working classes cannot consume enough of what of the value they produce. And indeed, that has often been the case, and there have been a lot of these cycles of prosperity, of recession. But it does not mean that that there cannot be also another deeper tendency in capitalism, a tendency that has been there from the beginning, and which is linked to the fact that living labor is replaced by technologies, and that also means that each time there is less less value in each commodity, and that might be an immediate advantage for each particular capital, but is a problem for capital as a whole.
Right.
So, and this problem has already existed in the 19th century. It has been overcompensated for a long time by the augmentation of production. But this thing could not last forever. There was a historical tendency which already was could be explained in theoretical terms, but which has also shown up on a historical scale from the 1960s on, that there was that the substance of labor given by productive abstractive labor was melting, was going down, especially with microelectronical production. And this means that there's also an inner limit to capitalist production, which is not cyclical, but which follows a historical growing tendency. In reality, these points probably have already been attained in the 1970s. For example, the abolition of the gold standard for the dollar was a very big sign of that. From that moment on, capitalism is mainly working with fictitious capital. That means by credit, mm-hmm. because it no longer works on its own term. So that means there is really a kind of collapse of capitalism, not a collapse which is taking place in one day, but which is a process which has already begun some decades ago. Mm. But on the other hand, this kind of end of capitalism is not at all identical to revolution. So this kind of ending up of capitalism might also only give way to processes of barbarization, of decomposition. So we have in a traditional Marxist view, capitalism would end because it produces its own enemies classically in the form of a very strong proletarian class. That also means in the traditional perspective that the end of capitalism is identical to the beginning of a new and a better story. Today it is quite the contrary. On a certain way, capitalism is working against itself, is destructing its own basis. But that does not mean at all that something better will automatically come after.
Well, I agree with you on the point that if we see capitalism collapse due to its own internal contradictions, that is, that could very well be leading us to barbarism. You know, the old slogan, socialism or barbarism. And there's no reason to think that socialism would arrive simply because capitalism falls apart. On the topic of, just to stay with crisis theory a little bit longer, it's one of these topics which I find really interesting. I wonder if my audience is going to get frustrated with me talking about it so much, but it seems to me, I mean, putting aside the question of the gold standard and money and how money has changed, it seems to me that if you had a deep enough crisis, that the two things would happen. One is that you had capital, abstract capital, would be devalued, so you could invest less into rebuilding and have an easier time making your money back and surpassing it, even when the commodities contained less value. But also, the machinery and the tools that you used for automation could very well be destroyed in, say, a war, which might come along with a capitalist crisis. The technological superstructural basis to rebuild the same level of technology could also be undermined, and the process of rebuilding that whole structure could, for a time, lead to a boom. Not that it wouldn't, again, eventually go into crisis, but I think it's really a technical question as to what would be required, how much intellectual property, in other words, just understanding of how to build and maintain these kinds of machines for automation would have to disappear to truly slow down production to maintain a long boom. But I just feel that at least there's a theory that can overcome that problem of automation leading to a decline in profitability. There's a crisis theory that says yes, this does that does lead to crisis, but then it overcomes itself through the destruction of capital, and on several different levels.
Yes, but on the other hand, today even asset capital in the material form is also less important than before, as compared to the technological know-how. The technological know-how cannot be destructed just by bombs, because it is also inside the hands of people.
Well, super, yeah, it's a question. It's something worth debating probably in more depth than we have time for today. What I'm interested in is when you started to look at Marx's categories again, either through the German crisis theorists or through Postone, how did that change your understanding of Debord? I know this is kind of tangential to your book, but I happen to own your biography of Debord and found it to be a very good book and worthwhile. And I was very much in my youth interested in and influenced by the SI, the Situationist International. So I'm wondering what you think of them now in today's context.
But I think more or less the same thing I already wrote in 94, especially in the French edition of my Debord book. I already made some changes as compared to the first Italian edition, on showing that there were two phases also in Debord. On the one hand, Debord was one of the really of the very first thinkers of his time to retake this kind of esoteric Marx, even if he did not call it like that. He really showed the consequences of commodity logic and of fetishism. And finally, his whole spectacle theory is not a theory about media. It is an explanation of what commodity does to society. And there he had some really very important insights. On the other hand, at the same time, the border situation is also stated to a much more traditional understanding of capitalism, as essentially centered about class struggle, only that they wanted partially to replace traditional proletariat with new kinds of people who had lost control over their lives and who knew it, as they said. On the one hand, there's a very important observation they made in their time, for example, about how much social antagonism was now centered around issues like urbanism and about control and about people's control over their own life on an everyday level. But on the other hand, they also stayed with some mythology, I would say, of the traditional working class and of factory proletarians. So as I said also in my book, the war was, I think, one of the first to go beyond a traditional Marxism, but we can say to a certain amount that you stayed in the middle of the river.
Well, in your book, The Writing on the Wall, you speak of us being in an anti-politics or stuck in a moment where the political isn't viable.
Yes.
Go into that a little bit, what you mean by that.
But so today, very often, especially on the left, and maybe especially in France, if I have to say, I wrote most of these essays on thinking about the French situation. There is the idea that they should retake real politics, real democracy, and that politics and democracy could finally overthrow or limit the dictatorship of economy. So that means that. They suppose a kind of distinction between an economical sphere, and capitalism is identified only with the economical sphere, and political sphere is often considered also on the left as something neutral of which you can get hold and use the state and politics for other issues, especially in order to control. To control the economy, for example, by imposing new and stricter laws about work, or by making it impossible to transfer enterprises abroad, or by putting higher taxes for the riches and so on. And so there is often the idea that what is needed is only a strong political will, and that even if leftist government go to power in Greece, and they do not realize this kind of intervention, they are considered as a kind of traitors. I think this is only a part of reality. I think behind there is a bigger structural problem that in a capitalist society, politics is completely dependent on economics. Capitalism means a real dictatorship of economy. And politics depend completely on economic issues. That's to say, the state or the politics can do nothing if they have no money to spend. Finally, politics means only decisions about how to spend money. And if capital goes away, today capital can go very easily away, or very easily flee to other markets, other countries, the state has no more possibilities as long as social reproduction takes on the means of money and distribution of money. The state will always depend not only on the economy, but even depend directly on international markets, on international credit, on rating agencies, and so on. So we have to overcome a political capitalist economy and politics both together by constructing other kinds of social life, not by imagining that it could be possible to use the state against the economy.
Right. Well, that's a very difficult pill to swallow, I think, for many people. I find it difficult. It's something that I agree with. In theory, but I don't see when you have someone in the United States like Trump elected, it seems vitally important. There's a pressure to participate in state politics and the electoral system that is very difficult to resist, especially when no radical movement or subject is really present. I don't know where to turn to organize to overcome society as it is, and who to turn to.
On the other hand, as it is well known, Trump was not even elected by a majority, only by less than a quarter of the Americans. It also means how useless it is to appeal to the election game. And it also, but also if somebody from the left would have come to power, which was already difficult to imagine, probably would have happened the same thing as happened in Greece with Syriza, who came to power probably with the best intentions, and finally they did the exact contrary on what they promised first, because they saw that, on the one hand, if you want to state, with all the system of work, money, value, and so on, you cannot just give it another twist. So, for example, if social life shall function by the state distributing money, the money must come from some place. And for example, as in the case of Greece, that money could only come from other from international financial institutions. I think the alternative can only be to construct circuits of social life where people, for example, product directly and exchange with other production unities, as has been tried a little bit, for example, in Argentina after the crisis of 2001. These kind of things should be become much more generalized. Naturally, if I criticize politics, I do not criticize at all some collective action. But I think this collective action cannot consist anymore in putting some hopes in the in institutions. It can only mean to take away whole panels of social reproduction from state and from market control.
So. In your book, you talk a bit about the threat that surveillance, the massive surveillance apparatus that exists in, you know, Europe and North America as well, and the real threat that poses to any hope of a radical movement. It seems like on the face of it, it's obvious it is a terrible threat. On the other hand, I feel, I guess, so despondent about the prospects of a radical movement arriving that I'm not sure how the surveillance state is being used right now. How do you think it interferes with our movement, what we might project into the future as a radical movement? And do you think it's the greatest limit to organizing, or has a kind of self-censorship taken hold, which is, I think, what I feel has happened? That's a greater threat.
But I would say on the one hand, surveillance is really a huge phenomenon. It has become always more enormous in the last years. It is also one of the most visible, and I would also say one of the most disgusting aspects of the capitalist organization of life. And I'm personally very sensible to that. I'm often astonished how many things people accept, how much humiliation they accept. For example, to show their bags when they enter into a shop and when they go to a swimming pool and like that. And at least in Europe, and particularly everybody is considered as a kind of potential terrorist. Maybe in France, this is even more visible than anywhere. Also, one of my essays is especially about this atmosphere in France, as if you would assist in a kind of military coup d'état. And it's true that it makes any resistance difficult, because it seems that the surveillance organs can know everything you do. I'm also a little bit surprised about the virtuous indignation, for example, indignation, you say, a scandal about, for example, the revelations of Snowden. I have never imagined that there would be any respect of privacy, for example, by the surveillance organs. So I well imagine that everything we do is directly registered some place. Well, but on the other hand,
now, because I mean, I'm sure that this conversation is already being, if I wasn't recording it, it would be recorded somewhere. already.
Yes, this is true. On the other hand, what often strikes me even most is not only direct political surveillance of email, phone calls, and so on, but also all the other devices we use and which permits us to be controlled, like credit cards, like GPS or radio frequency identification microchips. And in this case, normally nearly everybody collaborates directly. So you cannot speak of self-censorship. People find it life is so much easier by using these devices that you permit, for example, that everything you do can be followed and controlled. For example, it has become quite difficult to live without a credit card, even if some people do it. And in these aspects, what you see, this has become one of the most visible aspects of what is called the voluntary servitude. Recently, I read an article about it. Now, always more people accept to have microchips under the skin, which permits them, for example, to pay. And it often even becomes fashionable to be a kind of cyborg, to be all the time connected to surveillance devices. And this is, I think, even more difficult to fight against than political surveillance, since often people seems to want it. That also shows, one more time, that capitalism is not just a distinction between the rulers against the ruled. The ruled are often collaborate completely to it. And I have to say, I would really like to see a kind of civil rights movement against that, even if it has no revolutionary character, but just people, for example, for a question of human dignity, who would refuse all this kind of, for example, of control. That would already be a great thing.
I have teenagers. Now, we're going to move to this. And in your book, you write about the need for the abolition of television, which frankly struck me as a little quaint. Because
a little
outdated, maybe. Because in my house, the difficulty isn't television, it's the multiple screens that are connected to computers, whether it's the phone or a tablet, or usually phones or tablets, but sometimes laptop computers. None of my children have televisions in their room, but they all have computers in their room and multiple computers in their room. Today, my son, who's 15, came to breakfast and he was very depressed because the charging port on his smartphone had broken and he was going to have to leave his smartphone home because it wasn't charged anymore. And it was making him sad. It was really actually changed his whole mood to be disconnected from his smartphone. So what would you say that I should do as someone who, by the way, is just as bad as my teenage kids about being constantly connected, to make an argument against this?
I know there is a huge problem, and what I said is not only about television, but because all kind of connected screens. Even I have to say first that some people say that the other kinds of screens, internet has replaced television. It seems some studies show that they add it together. The people continue to look on television and they also look to other screens. So the hours a day passed by looking on screens have just doubled in the last maybe 20 years. Naturally, I know it because I also have children. It is not easy to convince teenagers of the dangers. But I think if parents and adults tell it them, it maybe leave some traces. It may have some effect later on. But what I would say is, I think if everybody admits that the most precious thing, especially for young people, is imagination. And in this case, looking all the time on screens, you get an imagination which has been created by others as a standardized imagination, an imagination which is sold like a commodity, so which is done, which is organized by people which have no friendly intentions toward the users, but who want to make money out, especially out of them. It especially this becomes an imagination which is nearly identical in different people. So normally, especially young people often like to stress also their personality, the originality. But in this kind, the real source of originality and personality, that's to mean imagination, becomes always more similar in people. And this is really different with books and with the cultures which were based on words. If you listen to a fairy tale or if you read a novel, everybody has its own personal idea. It gives other faces, for example, to the people, to the heroes of a novel. In the screen culture, nearly everybody gets more or less stays with the same version. So that also means in this kind of image or screen culture, there is no more surprise. There is nearly nothing to wonder about, and everything is already known. There is nearly nothing more to discover. Also, because there are no more stages in a childhood where little by little you discover also the hidden and mysterious aspects of adult life. And at the same time, everything stays extremely distant, since everything is just an image. It is not the same thing to stay with other, maybe, teenagers in a room to discuss, or it's not the same thing as doing a discussion on your smartphone. Everything is becoming so much distant, so much virtual, it loses its physical and emotional aspect. And I also think the presence of these images has something really totalitarian. It's maybe made even worse than traditional political regimes. For example, dictatorships tried to enroll children to youth organizations as Hitlerjugend in Germany and others. But families could also resist to it. They could also influence their children in another way. What is so difficult with these new devices, they have a very strong seduction power. And it is much more difficult to immunize people against seduction than against repression. So that means, yes, all these devices, finally they steal children from their parents, and they steal them to put into their heads something which is often much worse than that would happen in families. Maybe not always, but very often.
Well, I know what you're talking about. My youngest son, who's 12, doesn't have a phone, but he does spend quite a lot of time at a computer, and he reads, but he mostly reads comic books, and he draws. He will copy images out of comic books and from television and things he finds online. Obsessively, he's actually developed quite a talent for drawing cartoons, but yeah. So I'm just saying that. But what it strikes me is that his way of thinking is primarily visual, and as good as he is at drawing the comics, and I'm actually impressed by him and proud of him for developing the talent. But at the same time, I see that his style is very much the contemporary style of today's cartoons. That, you know, he hasn't developed his own voice at 12.
Yes, I know the problem very well. I also discuss it in my book La Société Autophage, the self-eating society, which has just been published last month in France. Where I also end up just by saying the problem is not only the contents of contemporary images, but also the fact that our culture is too much centered on images, and images often has a much more easy to manipulate than words or books. And an important American author, which I quote also on this regard, is Neil Postman.
Yes.
I don't know.
Amusing yes, ourselves to death. Yes, I know him.
Exactly. And I think he was someone which with simple words said some very important things about that. And I am convinced that if they are talking about the bad aspects of capitalist or bourgeois society, that is not only economical exploitation, but there's also a kind of anthropological change, we could nearly say an anthropological catastrophe, which is going on. And I think the changing state of childhood is one of the worst aspects of this anthropological revolution.
Right. Well, people complain the same way about my generation, you know. We're the TV babies. I'm part of Generation X, and we were all boob tube addicts, and our childhood was robbed from us by the television. But now you have, you know, smartphone kids, and it seems that they are even more in it. Yeah.
It was already happening, but when I was young, at least in Germany, there were only three television channels which were state-run, and there were maybe 1 hour a day a program which was fit for young people. So it was simply not possible to stay all days looking to screen them. Afterwards, in the name of freedom, there has such an explosion of the exposure to screens or even to other visual images, and I think that is really making an anthropological shift. But I have a lot of respect, especially for American authors like Shirley Turkle or Nicholas Carr, which are really showing these aspects.
Well, it is. I worry that I agree with you, but I worry that we sound like, you know, a couple of old 20th century geezers to some of our, you know, to the millennial audience. But I do think that it's true that there's a cultural shift going on, and that it's not, at least not completely for the better. I mean, the depth of understanding seems to be declining. Go ahead.
I have to say, I do not bother at all if people think that I'm not in tune with my time or something like that. So I think if things are going bad, I have absolutely, I am proud if people say that I maybe might nostalgic of the better time. This is also very typical of technological progress. First, when it comes, they always say, it's too early to know what it is about, to pronounce about it. And afterwards, they always say, no, it's too late. Now it's wrong. We can stop the train. I think it's not at all too. It is especially in the domain of technology, it is also possible to stop developments. So in the same way, for example, as the use of nuclear power has largely reduced in the world, in the same way genetic technologies are now regarded with much suspicion, at least in Europe, we can also do the same thing for other aspects.
So I think we've been talking for quite a little while, so we're almost to the end of this conversation. I've enjoyed it. I guess my question is, who do you imagine your ideal reader to be for The Writing on the Wall? Who do you think most needs to read your book?
I think everybody who thinks that there is something in this world which is not going very well. For example, also that means not only explicitly left-wing or Marxist readers, but also, for example, people worried about the ecological catastrophe, or worried about this kind of anthropological regression. And especially, I hope that I can say something to readers which are not just looking for a denunciation of one or several precise subjects, but who are also trying to understand what is behind that, if there is some more profound logic. And I think this is also really the importance of a renewed Marxian theory, to show that all the different problems of our world today finally have some common roots. It's especially the logic of value as a social nexus created by abstract labor. think this is also the difference between this kind of Marxist approach and other critical, more sociological approaches to not limit oneself only to separate spheres, but to see that as a kind of dictatorship of economy and labor, which explains also things which might seem very different, like for example climate change, unemployment, or overexposure to screens.